From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to be speaking with Chris Doty, the author of a new study that looks at some of the difficulties faced by Mormon missionaries when they come home early.
Clearly, the stigma and the assumptions are there, and it's really unfortunate because that's part of the reason why they come home being so scared, and they're very hypersensitive about how they're going to be treated because it's so different, it's so outside of the norm. They're expected to serve that full 2 years, and if anything is different, then it's assumed that they did something wrong or they're defective in some way, and nobody wants to feel that way.
That conversation, a legislative committee's recommendation that Medicaid be expanded in the state, and another look at the resignation of Attorney General John Swallow. All that just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later in the program, we're going to take a look at some of the difficulties that Mormon missionaries face when they come home early. But first up, we have these headlines. The Utah Elections Office revealed the final report of their special investigation of outgoing Attorney General John Swallow on Friday. The report cites 5 election law violations by Swallow, who will resign from office effective December 3rd. According to the report, if Swallow would be taken to court over the violations, the court, quote, reasonably should find him to be in violation of the law, unquote. 4 of the 5 infractions committed by Swallow involved failing to report sources of income greater than $5,000 within the year before filing to run for attorney general. Swallow's other violation was failing to report himself as an officer for SSV Management, a limited liability corporation. For more, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
This report comes just one day after Swallow announced his resignation, leading to speculation that the results of the Lieutenant Governor's special investigation influenced Swallow's decision to step down. Swallow denied that, saying instead that he saw no end in sight to the investigations, and the process was taking a toll on his family and finances. At Thursday's press conference, Swallow insisted that he had fully complied with investigations, but on Friday, the elections office shared a different account of Swallow's cooperation, saying he was, quote, inconsistent. At times, the embattled attorney general appeared, quote, genuine and cooperative. But the elections office bemoaned several actions by Swallow's attorneys, saying that they, quote, made several attempts to control or influence the course of our investigation, unquote. Investigators were also peeved by unanswered requests for documents pertaining to the case, even suggesting that Swallow's legal team had destroyed evidence. Friday's report recommended trying Swallow for his violations in court, thus leading to the possibility of removing him from office. However, because Swallow decided to resign, that option is now off the table. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
Utah Republicans have scheduled a December 14th meeting for the party's governing body to narrow down the field of replacements for the Attorney General. Governor Gary Herbert will then choose one of the 3 party-recommended candidates to fill Swallow's office until a special election can be held in November. In the meantime, Herbert has asked the general counsel for the Attorney General's office, Brian Tarbett, to oversee the office's operations. Meanwhile, Utah Democrats say they're poised to raise a legal challenge to that replacement process. The Democrats say Swallow should never have been on the ballot, and a new election should be held. A legislative task force researching Utah's health care options is considering recommending limited Medicaid expansion to the Utah legislature. The Health System Reform Task Force has narrowed their scope to 3 options for how to handle Medicaid expansion. The group has ruled out accepting full expansion as prescribed by the federal government, but 2 of the 3 options include a partial expansion of Medicaid in Utah. Lincoln Nearing, senior health policy analyst at Voices for Utah Children, says that a decision to accept some Medicaid funding allocated by the Affordable Care Act makes sense for Utah. As Nearing explains, if the state covers Utahns below the poverty line with Medicaid, that could allow those just above the poverty line to receive tax credits.
Their first choice was, let's see if we can expand Medicaid just up to poverty. And that's a good step. And then their next choice was, well, if the federal government is going to require us to expand up to 138 to qualify for the federal funding, we should look at providing that coverage through the private market, helping people through a premium subsidy to purchase coverage rather than enrolling in our existing Medicaid program.
While Nearing says he's very encouraged by the work of the task force, He worries that the process of negotiating a Medicaid expansion deal might be taking too long.
We have nearly 100,000 uninsured adults below poverty today. Pursuing a uniquely Utah solution to expand Medicaid, that's going to take time. It's going to take time to develop a plan, to negotiate with the federal government, and then implement that program, whatever it may look like. And most likely, we won't be able to get something in place until January 1, 2015. The challenge is we have people in need today that could really benefit from expanding Medicaid.
The third option still under consideration is not changing Utah's Medicaid eligibility rules, meaning an all-out rejection of Medicaid expansion. The Health System Reform Task Force eventually will make a final recommendation to the Utah legislature, and the final decision will rest with Governor Gary Herbert. Herbert is expected to make a decision in conjunction with the upcoming session of the Utah State Legislature in January. House Republicans debated some bills this week dealing with national parks. So what would those bills do? I posed that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
They haven't voted on these yet, but a couple of them, you know, don't actually seem to be too controversial. One of them is very controversial. So let's get down to it. One of them is a very simple bill that would allow the federal government to reimburse the states that paid during the government shutdown to reopen national parks. So the state of Utah got some money back that wasn't used, but there's still $1 million kind of sitting out there that the state wants to get back because, you know, the federal government was still getting the money from the tourists coming in. They were getting all the other kind of funds. And that one seems, you know, not very controversial, but it hasn't gone anywhere yet. So we'll see if that one, you know, makes it to the House or the Senate.
And so, Thomas, this would actually reimburse the state of Utah?
Yeah, exactly. So when Utah, you know, reopened Zion National Park and then paid the money into the federal government, they still haven't got the money back from the federal government. So this is legislation that would finally take care of that problem because it's been, you know, quite a while now, more than a month. Then there's another bill that Congressman Chris Stewart has introduced, which would say that the Interior Department needs to have these kind of agreements in place with the federal government already. So with the state, so that if there is another government shutdown or there's some reason that, you know, the national parks don't have funding, that the states would be able to take care of that. That one faced a little bit of opposition because there are Democrats who say, well, why don't you do that for Head Start? Or why don't you do that for cancer research? Or why don't you, you know, if the states want to step up and fund some parts of the federal government, they can't just pick and choose and decide to do the popular ones. They need to do some other stuff that impact people's lives, too.
Interesting. So, Thomas, turning away from that subject, the Senate went nuclear yesterday. What exactly does that mean?
Yes, we were all joking as reporters about the, you know, the radioactive nature of our lives these days. But being downwind from the Capitol is not a good thing. This is essentially something that's been talked about for quite a while, but was rushed through yesterday. And it is quite historic, however, you know, boring it may seem. The Senate actually did yesterday was change the threshold at which they get advanced legislation, kind of the easiest way to go for it. So before now, I'm sorry, not legislation, nominees. Before now, you had to get 60 votes for, say, the nominee to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and you had to get 60 votes before you can actually even vote on that person's nomination. You know, the Senate is one of those crazy bodies that has all these different kind of rules. Well, yesterday, they changed the rule. The Democrats pushed through a rule change that means that they only need 51 votes now, just a simple majority to advance a nominee and then confirm that nominee. So it really does mean, you know, with the Senate 53 Democrats, including the two independents that vote with them, that really does give them the power to, you know, push through, you know, the nominees that they want without any, you know, filibusters by Republicans. Of course, Republicans are very upset about this. Senator Hatch is very upset about this. I will note that there's an exception. The Supreme Court nominees still have to have 60 votes, and the 60 vote threshold is still there for all legislation as well.
Well, so then, Thomas, what does a post-nuclear Senate do now?
Well, they pass a lot of nominees. I think it's very simple. They actually did one yesterday right after they changed the rule. They pushed through a judge for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And we just kind of imagine that in the next, you know, few weeks following Thanksgiving that They're going to be pushing through, you know, all the other judicial picks who have been held up, or anything from the administration that's been held up. Democrats, you know, while they have the change, are going to use it.
Well, Thomas, I got to say it, duck and cover.
Yeah, well, we can try. Go upwind.
Thomas Burr is a Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes. You can find links on our website, kcpw.org. You're listening to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back. Today on The Rundown, we're joined by Dr. Chris Doty, a clinical therapist and chair of the Department of Behavioral Science at Utah Valley University. Doty led a team of students in his study that looks at what happens when a Mormon missionary returns home early from their mission. Doty discovered that 74% of early returned missionaries had feelings of failure, and 65% were uncomfortable in social settings as a result of cutting short their missions. So, Dr. Doty, the first question I have for you is, how did you conduct this study? What was sort of the origin of the study, and then why did you decide to focus on this topic?
Well, the idea for this study came from a discussion I had with a student. He had returned early from his LDS mission, and I had a couple of loved ones who had returned early as well. And we talked about how they, both the student and these other couple of folks, how they kind of navigated the process of coming home and what their adjustment looked like and how they felt they were treated by other people. And we saw some common threads in all of their experiences. And so my student and I wondered if this was fairly typical, that if this is how a lot of early returning missionaries are treated or feel, or, you know, if kind of it's a similar experience. And so we decided we wanted to look at the issue from a research perspective and see if we couldn't, you know, throw a little science behind it and find out what really was going on. So that's what we decided to do.
So then what are the nuts and bolts? How did you go about actually conducting the study?
Well, what we did is we weren't really sure what to ask because this has not been an area that has been researched before. So we kind of had to approach it first, actually from a mixed methods perspective. So first what we did is we did a set of qualitative interviews. So we interviewed 12 men who had returned early from their missions. And we basically asked them some very broad, open-ended questions. We were trying to cast a real wide net to see what kind of information we could get just to understand their experiences. So we did that with 12 of these young men, and then from that information, we developed a questionnaire, a survey, and we tightened it up, and then we put that out over social media. We had some support from some print media, and we put flyers out on some of the local college campuses. We tried to get the word out, you know, the best we could, and we ended up having 348 people go in there and actually complete the survey. So we were able then to analyze the data statistically. And so then we had some qualitative data, some interviews, and some depth of the experience. And then we had the quantitative piece, which was the survey results and the statistics.
And so what are some of the reasons that people return from missions early? And did they identify that in your study?
Yeah, we were pretty upfront about that in wanting to understand that. And we found that there were a real broad range of reasons why people come home early. Just from when we started with the 12 young men that we interviewed, you know, there was mental health, physical health, prior worthiness issues that they didn't resolve before they went out, or there was some disobedience to mission rules. Some of them came home just because for one reason or another, they no longer wanted to serve and just felt it was time for them to go home.
Sure. I imagine culture shock could play into that, or even just being, you know, so far away from home.
It is really difficult. And we felt that really didn't make, surprisingly, that wasn't what the biggest deal was. In fact, when we did our survey, we found that 36%, so just more than a third of them, came home for mental health issues. About the same number came home for physical health, but we only had less than 23% that came home for any worthiness-related issues, either pre-mission or during the mission. And I think that really kind of surprised me a little bit, because that tends to be the thing that people think the most when somebody comes home early. Oh, what did they do wrong?
So I'm wondering, have you been able to look at the perceptions of the broader community toward early return missionaries?
Our first round of research has really focused on the experience of the missionaries themselves and their perceptions of it. But as we broaden this research, we've really found that there's an agenda here that we want to pursue. We want to, next from here, look at parental response and also word response, so how people themselves are responding to these kids when they come home, and then even kind of go a little bit broader. And so, you know, we don't know what the other people think about them. We only know for sure what the missionaries perceive that other people are thinking.
You know, I can imagine that with the amount of time and preparation that, goes into getting ready for a mission, that there's kind of a sense of this is all for naught.
I think what people forget is that regardless of how long they've gone out and served, and they still gave time and energy and effort. And most of them were prepared as well as anybody. You know, they were worthy, they were willing to serve, they went out with the purpose that they were going to be able to complete the 2 years. And then something happened while they were out there that made that not happen. So coming home, you know, if there are other people that feel like it's all for naught, then it totally zeroes out the entire experience for them. And they feel like the scoreboard reads, you know, elder zero, instead of, wow, I served 5 months, or I served 13 months, or, you know, I did the best I could with what I had. And sure, it wasn't the full 2 years, but it still was a great effort. And I still accomplished a lot, and I still grew. It's like none of that stuff is taken into account. It's more of, wow, I didn't finish. Everybody's looking at me and judging me, and therefore the whole experience was meaningless.
You did a study earlier this year, I think, where you found that many LDS women in Utah were at risk for depression, and you referred to it as toxic perfectionism. I'm wondering if you could describe that, and also if that same pressure for perfectionism is at play here for early returned missionaries.
Well, there could be a connection, certainly. Basically, what toxic perfectionism is taking the idea of, from the scripture, be therefore perfect, and putting it on steroids. It just means that there's no room for flaw, no room for being human, no room for failure, that everything you need to do is more focused and driven by fear of what other people are going to think of you, fear of what God is going to expect, fear that you will disappoint God, and therefore you will not be able to achieve your eternal reward. And then just kind of projecting that on everything you say and everything you do. And so what that results in with women is that they feel like they've got to be the perfect mother, the perfect wife. They have to have the perfect body, the perfect spirituality, as though perfection means without flaw. And in reality, when we go back into the scriptures and we read, be therefore perfect, the footnotes indicate that what perfect means is complete. And so it doesn't mean without flaw, it just means complete. But we've taken that out of context and we've made it sound like we have to be perfect without flaw. And boy, nobody can do that. And so what it does is it puts people in this position where they're struggling with the cognitive dissonance of, gee, I'm supposed to be perfect, and yet it's completely impossible, and I can't reconcile that in my mind. So how this translates over into missionary work is that you've got kids that have this expectation of what the perfect mission looks like. You know, they'll go out in glory, you know, they'll have friends and family that are waving them off into the sunset, and they get letters all the time, and it's a wonderful spiritual experience, and they're baptizing people left and right. And then, you know, they come home and there's the balloons and the banners at the airport and the cake, and they're received in glory, and they get to speak in church and all these wonderful things. So that constitutes the perfect mission. And then what happens? Some of these kids come home and it isn't like that. You know, they come home early. It's not expected. There are no balloons and banners at the airport. We had one young man whose parents didn't even show up to the airport to pick him up. They said, you just need to come home yourself. And then they finally, you know, consented and came and picked him up. But it doesn't come out that glorious, perfect way that they had hoped. And then all of a sudden, because it's either all or nothing, then that must mean the whole experience was for naught. And it's really a shame, because it isn't like that. We're not focused on whatever amount they give is good enough. Whatever they accomplished while they were out there is acceptable.
Did you look at both men's and women's experiences here, or did the study focus on just men?
The qualitative piece was all men, and the reason why we did it that way is because there is more of a cultural expectation for the young men to serve than it is for the young women. That now is looking different now that the age change, you know, the age has been lowered. More girls are feeling that pressure to go. So it's going to be interesting to look at this in a couple of years and see, you know, see if the age changes had that kind of an effect. But when we did the actual survey instrument, we opened it up for men and women to take. We've not analyzed the data by gender largely because only 19% of the people who completed the survey were women. We're going to go in and do some non-parametric statistical analysis and see if we can't kind of make some sense out of that. But for the time being, we only looked at the broad mission experience overall.
I'm wondering if through the study you've come up with a way to provide some kind of measure of relief for people who feel stigmatized here.
We actually have a couple of clinical recommendations and also social recommendations. And the first one is that just by the very fact that this study is getting so much attention, it's clear that we've struck a nerve. And we had no idea it was going to be this big of a deal, but I've had more email and phone calls and contacts than I ever thought that I would from this. And so, you know, people are willing to talk about it. It's been traditionally a taboo subject, largely because nobody's known what to say or do. And so they've just kind of not dealt with it. Well, now that it's out there, people are willing to talk about it. And so I'm getting invitations to speak and to do some other things to talk about this. So the awareness is the first thing. But from a clinical standpoint, we get a lot of these kids that are coming home for mental health reasons and for other reasons. And regardless of the reason that they come home, they need to have a safe environment in which to tell their story from start to finish. Most of them feel like when they report to church leaders or, you know, to family, that there's already people saying, okay, we've got to work on getting this child back out. And that may or may not be a possibility. And even more, the missionary needs to be able to say, you know what, I appreciate the opportunity, but I really, for whatever reason, I'm really not wanting to go back out, or I really don't feel that I can at this point. I'd really like to move on. And a number of these kids don't feel like they have a safe environment in which to express that. So I'm hoping that by talking about this a little bit more, that it will empower these kids to be able to sit down with their parents or their priesthood leaders and say, you know, I really tried and I, you know, gave it my best effort, but I think what's best for me right now is to take this other road, to go back into school, or maybe to take a year off and think about something else. But at least they need to be able to feel safe and not judged by saying what they really feel and what they really would like to do.
Well, Dr. Doty, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for taking the time. This has been very interesting. We appreciate your speaking with us today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Chris Doty, a clinical therapist and chair of the Department of Behavioral Science at Utah Valley University. She led a team of students in a study that looks at what happens when Mormon missionaries come home early. You can find this interview and all of the conversations we feature on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. That's all the time we have for our show today. The Rundown was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Tyler Ford, and Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Monday on the program, we'll take a look at the end of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations and have a conversation with incoming Salt Lake City Council member Aaron Mendenhall. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.